Hello, world! We're Yulia and Ina, curious and passionate teachers and lifelong learners. We're co-hosting this podcast to talk about how we live and learn, encourage and teach. We'll share how we move countries and cultures and how we adapt to change and mentalities. Basically, how we live and learn.
Well, how are you living and learning this week?
I'm mostly online.
Cool.
Mostly collaboratively with other people. And I'm part of a couple of projects at the moment. And I'm learning to cooperate through these virtual collaboration applications. And I'm having a lot of fun.
Super. And could you share some of your feelings, emotions about it? Like, how is it? Because many people nowadays say that they're exhausted, extremely tired of being constantly present online, etc., that they lack real communication, as they call it. How does it feel to you?
I do miss real communication because I'm a person who loves hugging everybody, you know, touching the glasses of wine or water, I don't know, enjoying the surfaces of the tables and so on. So I really like this sensory input. As for visual input or audio input, I can say that, yes, with the quarantine, we've been exposed to a much bigger volume of digital information than I used to have before, and that many webinars, that many online discussions, that many podcasts we are doing, for example, and online lectures. Like yesterday, I had a 4 hours long lecture, with the students. So it is something that takes a lot of energy, takes a lot of time, but as well is known as Zoom fatigue. So today I learned what we can say about this word as Zoom fatigue.
Is it a new term?
Yeah.
That appeared now at this period of time, exactly.
Yes. So this is COVID-related or more quarantine-related thing. That people who didn't used to work online all the time, so who were not the freelancers or online teachers, and who had to transform into the online environment, they are experiencing extreme Zoom fatigue because they don't know how to deal with, you know, staring into your eyes an hour and a half, 2 hours, 9 hours, 6 hours. And that is actually a part of the discussion that we've had with you and we've had in the educator circles. Is it legitimate to call what everybody is doing right now teaching people through Zoom? Is it legitimate to call it online learning or online education? Yeah, what do you think? Do you know, do you get exposed to what's happening in schools and universities? How people study or teach?
Luckily, I'm not personally part of this. And as you know, and our listeners also know that I started teaching online much earlier than it became a trend. I am so really empathetic to people who had to start now and they had no choice if not to teach online at this period of time. So on the one hand, it's a great opportunity because people finally haven't got any excuse not to teach online, saying, oh, probably it doesn't work. Oh, it's not so efficient. You just don't have any other choice in times of emergency. But this is actually teaching in times of emergency or teaching and learning in emergency, but not really online teaching and online learning. I read it on one of your recent Facebook posts that we cannot and should not compare online teaching and learning to learning and teaching in times of emergency. It's not the same thing. It's not enough just to turn your video cam on to start calling this kind of education, learning, teaching, an online one.
I think it is still an online one because that's how, either online or offline, right? It's like either private or in a group. It is still online, but it's, I agree here. And what you're mentioning is the, a couple of weeks ago, I heard the webinar from Global Institute for Lifelong Empowerment, which said that that is a emergency distance teaching because everybody was locked where they are, obviously online teaching, or but this is still an emergency thing because most of people just had their classes or lectures, turned the camera on and did the very same thing, which is not the collaborative way of online learning. So there is no synchronous and asynchronous, or very little, or not everybody's prepared, or not everybody's trained. I'm talking about the teachers now. And for example, the universities, so they had to manage how to translate, or today I had this beautiful term from an academic paper, emergency online migration. So like the universities had to migrate online because of the emergency situation. And therefore they were focused on how to make it work technically, but not necessarily all of the departments, universities, or I don't know, courses had the time to train the teachers. And again, most probably some teachers who were curious already started learning how to do this, how to implement, what's the difference, what can I do differently, what can I change, what, how can I make people work more, practice more, speak more, train more, collaborate, discuss. And this is all what is probably much more a means and methodology of online education rather than just clicking the cam on.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Then some students and school students I work with individually and online for a lot of time said that they had troubles learning in emergency now because most of them know how to use technologies, know how they can use gadgets in an efficient way, while teachers mostly don't. There are some good things to this. For example, collaboration between students and teachers, when students can teach teachers how to use technologies. And this is something that can help teachers to stop feeling superior and start seeing their students as equal humans, which is not always the case at schools.
You're talking about the revolution now.
Am I?
Yes, you are. The teachers are ready to leave their superior position if we're talking about at least schools. Okay. Most probably the coaches, facilitators, and people with a lot of experience in collaboration, yeah. But if we're talking about the vast number of people who teach every day in schools, or again in universities.
So it's a challenge, I would say. Good you mentioned revolution, because if evolution does not happen, it's time for revolution. And schools need it. Just one thing is that schools cannot afford having such relationships, sadly enough. And still, students who said that some teachers were ready to have this exchange and to learn how to use technologies, how to use their gadgets efficiently, etc., could get over this crisis and be helpful to their students who are also experiencing hard times now. At the same time, school obviously is not ready. I'm in secondary school now, but I believe universities are also mostly not ready for changing the way they teach. And it's a great challenge. for teachers, for university and school management as well. So this is something that needs to be changed greatly. And then what we are doing as tutors or as coaches is something that we can try and then forward for other people in the sector to try and use and see how it can work in their institutions. So we could be probably helpful as individuals starting to do something, trying something, and then sharing our experience for broader use.
You know, I have some kind of the commentary to this, because I'm not really familiar with what is happening with the school, secondary school level, but I'm somehow related to what's happening to the higher education, being a part of, like, collaborating with three universities here in Berlin. What happened is that I think that universities did a great job. To my understanding, in the emergency situation, you really need to have the whole paradigm of emergency, right? You need to have crisis management. You need to understand how to deal with this, how to deal with this quickly, how to deal with it most efficiently, with not probably enough funds, because they were not foreseen for such a disruption. But as well, it was the emergency over here when everybody understands that they are just like emergency in the hospital or firefighters, where everybody understands that if they don't do it now, everybody is on fire. So, like, the school year won't finish if everybody doesn't do its part. And I need to agree as well. I'm referring to this webinar on future of education. I have agree here with the idea that the teachers did actually a great job of saving the school year for the whole, like, for all the students, sometimes through their own learning on the place, right at the time. So when they need to switch, when they had to switch to online presence, like overnight, basically, within a week or two. And as well, I need to say that sometimes this is, again, at the cost of every teacher, because, again, Zoom fatigue, being online, trying to understand how it works, making the mistakes, making the, seeing the failures, not switching off the camera, not switching on the mic. I didn't know, some students are not switching on the camera, saying they have a bad connection, and then you're ending up talking to just the names on the avatar, so you cannot see the reaction. So
there was a funny meme somewhere on the internet with a picture of an online classroom on Zoom with students and their avatars. One having changed his or her avatar into the black screen with the word reconnecting. And this is something that shows creativity of students. Like, okay, guess if it's really reconnecting or just a changed name. And it's funny, and at the same time, another challenge to teachers to create rapport with their students in order not to provoke such situations.
Yeah, but sometimes, for example, I had to start teaching new group who I didn't know. I hadn't met them before. They hadn't met me. And it was quite a difficult thing to build this rapport with people who are switching on, switching off, getting in, getting out of these lectures. What I wanted to mention here as well is that what helped me personally is a great number of emergency webinars that were introduced in the beginning of the lockdown. I told you that I wasn't the first timer in online teaching as well. So I've been teaching since 2014, somewhere there. And I wasn't new. I already had the tools, I already knew how to do this. But the virtual collaboration webinars, which were given the tools practice, mindset were extremely helpful to me to support my personal transition to totally online.
Yeah, without having a chance to meet these people personally, you have to do all the job of meeting them, of creating your relationships, all of it online.
Yeah, and so being on the side of the universities, I need to say that what I hear from the students is that it is very difficult to them. They are surviving, they are struggling because they are not used to. Because, for example, if I am an online teacher or you are an online teacher, most probably you have your physical space to have it managed, right? Most students said that they didn't have a quiet place where nobody disturbs them. Some students said that they were not ready because they just didn't have the laptops. They were using smartphones forever. So they are not using laptops as much. I know that one of my friends, because their school was transitioned to the online teaching, so they decided to make the technical drawing course online during this period. And funny enough, a lot of people don't know how to work with the mouse, because they already started being digital when the laptops with this touchpad started. So for them, it was weird to use the mouse for a technical drawing, because it is quite precise and there is a lot of specific key functions, right, that you can do it. And if you are skilled, you gain this knowledge. But if you are not and you just don't understand how this ARCHICAD works, so I saw the frustration on my friend's eyes, like, how old are you guys? Seriously?
You can actually tell how old someone is from which things they can use and which they cannot. And yet, what are some of the useful tools that can be used in this era of digital learning, online learning and teaching?
I guess everybody does their own lists of what exactly they should be doing and what exactly they need, because it's quite a different set of the functions that you need as a teacher or as a coach or as a trainer or as a student. But what comes to my mind is the students of XU University, the University of Digitalization, came out with the visualization of all the digital collaboration tools that they are using for businesses, for individuals, for remote, work remotely from home, and all together to embrace the digital collaboration.
Oh, that's cool. And that would be nice to see which of them we use and which we think is a good idea to be using.
So what they did, they took the tools for video conferencing, for content creation, for communication, live events, right? So to go live on YouTube or whatever, project management, data sharing, feedback, and like more broadly the online courses. So
okay, could we start with probably content creation, as this is something we do before we start a lesson? We create content that we will use with our students and that we prepare for our students to use during the lessons as home task, as project work, etc.
Again, that would be very different from industry to industry, but if you're working with text, so most probably that's Microsoft Word or Google Docs, yeah, where you're able to share the document to work simultaneously with people.
Yeah, exactly. As a big fan of Google in terms of tools that I use, I actually am for Google Docs and I share documents that I create with my students. I sometimes, honestly, also save what I've created in Google Docs as a PDF file, for example, if I think sharing is not the best option, if we're not going to work on this document further on, but it's just some information to be saved as a list of things or as whatever information can be just for your interest. And still, when we need to work on a document together during the lesson, or a student might do a task and then share the results with me for me to check or whatever else, then sharing a Google Doc is something I widely use in working with students.
I normally use Google Slides because that's the lectures or the webinars or seminars. Or again, even if I teach privately or for a company, I do the slides because they, to me, they are much more flexible because I can hide the slides, duplicate slides, make the, once I made the template, incorporate more and more. And as well, I really love them because I can incorporate media and I'm doing a lot of audio, video, links in my slides already, so that you just click on it and you're already on TED Talks or I don't know, any podcast, whatever is there. And
well, it's the same on Google Docs, I would say. You also can use links and then direct or redirect.
But I need this nice design. I need it to be friendly. I need it to be to see that it was created specially for this particular person or company or university. Mm-hmm. And actually, it is much easier to me to think in slides. So when I'm doing the lecture, so I'm working a lot with the draft part, you know, when you have the sequence of slides, and I'm just trying to put my information so that it looks logically structured, and then to put it up, put it down, and so on. But for me, it's a easier tool, let's say. Okay, it requires a bit more formatting if you are not using templates. If you are using templates, so, and actually I'm coming to Canva because it was a recent find for me. And I think
it's fantastic. I just adore it, honestly.
I think this is something that everybody needs to say thank you to the advances of technology, that we are all able to be using much more professional design than any of us could ever create manually.
Could even imagine creating.
Yeah, but when you are a proficient PowerPoint or Google Slides user, when you know how to template, how to structure all your slides, right? So that you, all the changes you are doing are incorporated to all of them, then it is much easier for you to do the Canva. Because like if the people are just creating each slide individually, that would require enormous effort to transit.
As for Canva, one more thing I'd like to add in terms of how I use Canva, not for creating slides, but for creating completion certificates for some of my individual students. This is wonderful. Like it allows you to create individual, like to have an individual approach to a student, to choose an image, a style, an atmosphere that you want to share with the student. Like I've got young learners who really appreciate and get motivated by having this certificate. Like today you were a great reader and here you are, like this is your certificate of completion that you were a great reader, or this month you've completed this or that. And Canva allows you to personalize this stuff. It's not much work or hard work if you can do that. It's so rewarding and it's so motivating. I think adult students deserve this approach too, but for young learners, it's a crazy thing to use.
Fantastic. I would have been, you know, it reminds me of the stickers that we had in our notebooks not the notebooks, not the laptops, but the real paper.
The notebooks, the pads. Yeah, true. And also, if we talk about Zoom, like to someone, it might provoke Zoom fatigue. To someone like us who have been using it as a tool for teaching, it also gives extra resources. Like they've recently added reactions, for example. And this is something that also my young students use during the lesson. I might use them up, great job. And my students also use them when they think my explanation has been clear. And just at that time they react, not saying, oh, okay, it's clear, thanks. They put a thumb up or they put that reaction of clapping hands. Like, thanks, got it. It's interactive, it's beautiful, and it's lively. So this is something that can be used as well. Still, you need to know that it exists and not to be frightened of touching another button, yeah, to see what might happen if you do it.
It was actually a very nice tool when we had a association meeting and we had a voting moment when all the board members had to vote for question A, question B, question C. So basically what is fantastic is you just get a slide. Question A, do we agree on ta-dun, ta-dun, ta-dun? And then the person says, please vote. And you are just putting here and in some kind of the chat, I think it's in participants, yeah. You can, when you have a group, a lot of people, you can as well put thumbs up, thumbs down, later, and so on, so on. So basically it was much easier for the person who is writing the minutes to calculate and say who's on, how many voices are for and against, for example. And I was actually really impressed how quickly it went because we had like, I don't know, let's imagine seven questions to put on vote. And from my previous experience, that would take like, what, 30 minutes to question, to say, to count. That was just like 5 minutes. First question, everybody's ready? Yeah, I'm counting. 7, 4, 3 against, for example. Perfect, perfect. Moving to slide number 2. Do we agree? And then everything's written. It's everything clear. Or for example, somebody says, I don't agree with the wording here. Can we change the wording to this to make it more clear? The person edits it online, live, right at the moment, and then everybody agrees. Yes, we agree with this wording or not.
So it's fast and efficient and it saves you time, absolutely. Which brings us from content creation to communication.
Communication. Well, we use Slack with a couple of projects. We use Teams in one of the universities. What else? We use internal communication tools for another university. I communicate a lot through Facebook and LinkedIn. And I'm a newly born user of Twitter, five days old. Congratulate me.
Congratulations. You're my bird. Tweet, tweet.
That's curious. I use Telegram sometimes, but I know that Telegram is widely used in Russian-speaking world and is not that way that much known here. Here in Germany, people use WhatsApp a lot and Meetup. I don't know, which communication tools are you using?
Well, mostly Zoom for online lessons. And what I normally do is I just start a meeting and send an invitation, or just before a meeting, if I have time to schedule earlier and I know that the meeting is not going to be rescheduled a couple of times, like I don't like this stuff. So if it is sure and scheduled, then I send a link or just add a Zoom meeting to a description of an event. Or if I just start a new meeting and send an email with an invitation, or else with some students, I copy an invitation and send it to whatever messenger we normally use for communication. So it's variable. Email, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and there's too much individual approach, if you wish. But actually, I'm trying to make it similar to most people. Like if I choose to use an email invitation, I'd rather use it. But there are still some people who prefer a Facebook Messenger and they ask me, could you please send an invitation there? Well, okay, that's not a big trouble for me to do so. So I prefer maybe an extra effort, but a better relationship than similar process for everyone with the lack of personalization, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I think that, again, with different universities, I have all three universities have three different ways of video conferencing and of their primary choice for communication channel. Yeah, otherwise I would get lost already, I guess, because there are so many streams of communication, private, project, university, I don't know, teaching, or for example, again, something with tea, something with, I don't know, book club. And there are so many streams that sometimes it's really important to handle them. And to handle it properly, I think there is, again, the time management skills that everybody needs to brush up a little bit. We are talking about tools, but as well, there should be the mindset for using the digital things. Just as you said, just try to, just go and try what this
go works. And try, like, better done than perfect, as I often say, especially recently. Better done than perfect, meaning that if you never start, you'll never master the skill. So you have to start somewhere and then see if it works for you, see if you can get over this Zoom fatigue or realize that it's absolutely not something for you. But you need to try and do in order to understand.
I think your phrase fights two syndromes. One is procrastinating, that, like, better done than
perfect, just do it.
Yeah, that helps with procrastination and with the perfectionism.
And I think these are two sides of the same phenomenon, actually. Perfectionists are the best imposters in their own mind. Like, I will not publish this paper until it's perfect, and I will be doing it and editing it forever because I never believe it's enough.
Forever and ever and ever and ever. Yeah, but I think it's an important thing to see the whole project planned on one page. Just like 2 days ago, I shared with one of my friends who is doing her PhD work a template with one A4 piece of paper, or I don't know, that's something that you can print on a piece of paper. Anyway, I'm still thinking in looted ways, like all good papers.
But it's absolutely natural. When you move to Germany, you have to get back to these paper things, because if not, you're just not integrated.
Thank you.
I feel the pain.
Nice pun. Yeah, and there was all the parts, all the necessary rubrics of a PhD thesis written on one page in nice writing, in exact phrases and questions. So, for example, methodology, and then you have the questions, what you need to answer. And then, for example, like empirical studies, what you need to describe. And it is a nice way to do the project management scope, right? To put it to a little piece where you can check what is done, what is not. So this is kind of a project management approach. to such an important project in the life.
Especially to such an important project, because the bigger it is, the better you need to be able to scale.
Scale up and scale down.
So you can see the whole picture, and you can also scale down to see it in detail, and then to scale up to analyze every single piece or moment or part of your work, and then scale down again, etc.
It's actually nice, because when we were teaching English, business English, or academic English, we used to have a book with 12 units with reading, writing, speaking, practicing in it, and there was this scale. You understood where you are in this map, because normally the books have this 2 pages open with all the units, so that's your map of your adventure, and you can see where you proceed. It's actually nice to see, okay, here we've done that, and so on.
Yeah, like a roadmap.
Exactly. But now, when we're using so many digital materials, so many extra materials, so many extra curriculum things, or skills approach, when you're skills oriented and you're not studying the grammar or reading and writing, but if you need, for example, negotiation skill practiced, or presenting, or CV writing, or cover letter, or like anything, and you're focused on this, I think it's extremely, I wanted to say cool, but it's not all to say cool. It's extremely useful to use this approach anyway. So in this case, you can show what's the path, where to go, how we are proceeding, to have this milestone checked, like with a little bit of praise. I think it always helps.
It's cool that you said it's not cool to say cool. It reminds me of a person I listened to on another podcast, a native English speaker, who said that he had a definite definition for something, and then he stopped and said, definite definition? Yeah, definite definition. And went on talking about something. So, all right.
Okay, so can we talk a little bit about how to collaborate during the courses? Do you have the individuals, or do you have the groups? How do you put people together to practice?
I choose to work individually. And so I don't put people to practice during the lessons. What I do instead is I'm an active participant of all the dialogues, exchanges, all the language experience that we have during the class. So I'm always there actively participating. And then I always give it as an example to my students that, okay, you can understand me well because you're used to my way of talking. Then go out there to the internet, outside if it's possible, to another country, to a language camp, to any of multiple and various areas where you can practice the language. Go there and practice and see how it works for you. And then you can get back and share your experience of how it was, whether you felt any difficulty, insecurity, and then we can work on these things back in class. So I do not organize any pair work or group work, any pair work if not for me as a participant, but then I invite people to go out there and practice and become part of the English-speaking world in any context they can find.
Mm-hmm.
What about you? How do you organize this stuff?
I would want to boast that I'm doing that super cool as an expert, but I'm learning. I need to say that every day I'm learning and I'm finding something new, I'm implementing something new. So when I'm having a group, for example, in most cases this is the university thing, I think it's important to first know the difference between the types of the teaching. So if I have a lecture, Like even formally, I need to give a lot of material which is already structured. What is not important is taken away, so it is really condensed. And because it requires a lot of this material, condensed material together, it doesn't really give a lot of time for practice, which is a pity for me. So I would probably really want to come back to lecture practice or lecture workshop. Or what we did back in Kyiv is while we were having a lecture, so if it is not like 40 people or 20 people, if this is a lecture for 15 people, I would most probably combine the types, the lecture, and then now you're doing the group work or the, like, you discuss it and you come back with the results and we are making one table, which is more efficient when students actually fill in the structure you're giving them with their ideas. And then all you need to do is just to fill in those 3-5 that they didn't come up with. So in this case, they are practicing, they are discussing it, and it becomes their knowledge. However, before the virtual collaboration campus, I thought that such a pity we cannot do this online. But then they showed me that actually all their facilitation that they are building is done in this scenario. So you have a question, you get people together, you give 5 slides about what you're talking about, what are the problems, what are the cons, what are the situations, what are the contexts. And then you just send people to, depending the number of the people, to the breakout rooms with, for example, 1 or 2 or 3 questions that they need to come up as a group. And so everybody goes for 10-15 minutes and discussing their experience, because everybody is there is already a professional, they have something to share, they have their experience, their expertise. And when they come and build in one document with the rigid, well, not rigid, but with the structure that you can see that the puzzles get into their place, and everybody creates it, then everybody owns this table, and everybody can most probably then comment, I heard what the other group was saying and I could add here. And that becomes such a collaborative situation that I actually dream to use this more in the university environment. And this is something that can help to learn much quicker through doing, right? Learning on the spot.
Okay, nice. And we need to do in this context, like I cannot say that I'm an expert here, but I'm learning, is a fantastic approach to doing anything we do in life. And instead of procrastinating or always striving to perfection, not by doing, but instead of doing, this is something that I think both of us and everyone else, if they wish, can use as a takeaway from our today's talk, for example, and try and see whether it works for them, whether we can really stop procrastinating and start learning by doing. So I think it's time to live and learn.
Curious about what we discuss next? Join us, live and learn.